Bill Adelman. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Susie for asking me to talk tonight. It's an honor and a privilege to speak to your home group. Like Jane, I'm also a member of the class of 73. And now I want to hear it. Yeah. I won't go into all that again, but she did. But class of 73 was very important to my sobriety. And Alcoholics Anonymous was very important to my life. And everything that's good about my life today, I know I wouldn't have if it wasn't for this program and the fellowship of AA. Before I got to AA, I was just putting in the time till I died. And that's how positive things were. So that was your day. It was either shitty or not so shitty. That was it. And I didn't come here for any particular right reason. I came here for all the wrong reasons, but more important, God made me stay. I mean, I don't know how I stayed, but the attitudes I had and the involvement I had, but fortunately I was one of the lucky ones who was able to stay here. You know, my sponsor Chuck talks about it. You know, so many people come to AA and things don't get good for them right away, and they'll stick around for a while and then they leave, and you never know if the next day is going to be the day that you turn the corner and you start to see a ray of hope. And that's what I found here. I mean, without AA, my day today wasn't a terrible day, but it was just a hectic, crazy day that I couldn't have envisioned drinking. I mean, it was just putting out one fire after the other. I mean, I'd be working on one and two others would spring up, you know, and finally about 4:15, I said, let them burn, I'm going to make coffee, you know? They'll still be burning tomorrow, so what the hell. But, you know, I also think I was an alcoholic, or I was a horrible, neurotic misfit from birth, anyway. I like to blame my early childhood growing up in a slums of Union City in a tenement apartment house where you had a four-floor walk-up and no dumbwaiter, so you threw the garbage down the dumbwaiter shaft and that type of situation. But they were the best days that I really had when I look back at it objectively. Didn't have anything and nobody around us had anything, so consequently there was nothing to miss and nothing to know we were missing. And I got along pretty good. I think I relatively fit in, but I had this need to, I don't know what the need was, but I just had to be part of, and I had to do what the other people were doing, and if I was going to be doing it, if I was going to do anything at all, I had to do it well. And typically I didn't try to learn anything. I had to do it instantaneously well, or I wouldn't want to look bad learning, you know, fall on my ass learning how to ice skate. I never did that because I just couldn't take the humiliation. So consequently, in my early youth, the only talent I learned was stealing, and that's because that was all there was to do there. And everybody did it. I mean, talk about it being bad for you. Well, I went so far as to go to religious instructions and make my first communion, mainly to get out of school early to hit the food stands before all the other kids rifled them out, you know, get a better selection. But that's what I was. I was a good shoplifter, and that was all I had going for me when I was about 13 years old. And my father came home from work one day and he said that we were moving, and we packed up and moved from this town of Union City to one of the wealthiest communities in Westchester County. And all the time, I didn't know it at the time, that I thought we were poor, he was just saving his money to buy a house. And you know, he didn't believe in things like mortgages or anything like that, so he'd save and save and save, you know, dime and quarter here until he had enough to buy a house. And we moved up into this town, and I think that's when I really went off the deep end. Because we moved up there, and right away I started school, and I walked into that school thinking I was pretty cool, going to teach these country kids how to steal, and Nobody was interested in it. Everybody had too much money. You know, everybody got big allowances. Everybody belonged to the country club and played golf and did horse, you know, rode horses and all that type of stuff. And I felt alienated, you know. And, you know, it was a tough couple of years from the time I was about 13 or 14 until I was 16. During that time, I just didn't fit in. I hung around with a couple of weirdos, but that was my life, you know. But, you know, to excel, I took up snake and turtle catching, you know, and I was one of the better ones, at least in the county. But that was a skill. That was a sport that there wasn't much competition in, you know. that was the only athletic event, you know, activity that I did well at, you know. But anyway, I just had a tough couple of years. And then I was 16 years old. A couple of the guys that I knew, not the rich kids, the townies, you know, I just couldn't identify with these kids. They suggested I go with them to one of these towns on a river, and they used to go out drinking. And we went to this town, and of course it had bar after bar. It had a Chevrolet plant in it, and it had to have a lot of bars to service the workers. And at night, especially if Chevy wasn't working, these bars were hungry, you know, for business, so they'd serve anybody. And I went out there, and I got drunk the first night on about $2 worth of beer. I came home, and I went to bed, and the room started spinning, and I got sick as hell. If I'd gone to AA, I would have learned how to stop the room from spinning, but unfortunately, I didn't learn that till it was way too late. But I threw up, got sick as hell, and I said, you know, I got to learn how to do this better, because this is the answer. This made me feel comfortable, you know. And it made me feel like part of society, and that was really the story of my drinking. From that point on, was after I learned how to drink and not throw up anymore, was just getting enough alcohol to feel the way I felt that first night, and just to feel comfortable. And and it was always a problem of supply, you know. Supply. I never had the money to drink the way I wanted. You know, for the first time, I turned off school completely. Not that I was excelling in it, but I was at least going. But I got a part-time job. I stopped eating lunch and saved my lunch money. And, all I looked for was the weekends. And I wanted to have enough money to go out drinking on the weekends. And that was it until, I guess that lasted about 6 or 8 months till they threw me out of that high school. And then I had to go to another high school, you know. But this time the old man had to buy a car because you couldn't get there any other way. So now I went to another school with this school here was a private school with kids with mucho bucks. And they didn't have any wheels. And I had the wheels, but I was always tapped out. So with their money and my wheels, we went out drinking, not just on the weekends, but several nights during the week. And, it, you know, it was just wonderful. And that lasted about 6 months, so I got thrown out of that school. And I didn't know, you know, it just wasn't working out. I had a drink, you know, I didn't think I did anything wrong or get into any trouble. I just, that's all I did was drink and have a good time and try to fake it during the day and fake it all week until the weekends. I tried working after that. I tried a couple of jobs. I got fired from my first two jobs, the only jobs I ever got fired from. And I knew work wasn't for me, so I went into service. And I was disillusioned right from the beginning. When the first morning they got us up at like 5 o'clock in the morning to wash clothes, you know. And, hey, women wash clothes where I came from. And that's primary purpose. this was humiliating, I'll tell you. And I had signed up for 4 years. So I did the best I could. And all the time I was in the service, I lied when I got in. I was sent to a school, electronics technician school. But another thing happened during this time. Living in New York, you could drink at 16 without any problem, and everything's cool. And by now, I was 18, so I didn't even care. But then you get sent to these goddamn states where they want you to be 21 to drink, and you have to go through that whole goddamn lying routine again. You know, I had thrown away my driver's permit that I had forged, and I forged my ID card, and it didn't look that good, but, you know, I used it as best I could, and I
hung out in the sleazy areas where you know, it wasn't all that important. But I went to school and I drank. That's all I did. You know, when you look back, the service was great. All you got to do is show up and pretend like you're working, and you got a room and board, and it's a great place for somebody like me at that time. I had problems in the service. I worked on specialized equipment. You know, this was another pattern I had. Whenever I had a conflict, I couldn't resolve conflicts. I used to work on equipment that worked in conjunction with stuff on planes, and the damn stuff didn't work right. And actually, the equipment was junk. The stuff on the planes was even worse. But there were all these guys on a plane saying that their stuff was working, and it was only me saying it was my stuff that was working, so they kept telling me my stuff was on a fritz all the time. And I tried to, you know, I couldn't fix it. It was working. It was working to the best of its ability, you know? And these clowns like to fly their airplanes at night, and they wanted my equipment working at night, and I preferred sleeping at night. But they wanted me to go out there and fix this damn stuff at 8, you know, 10, 11, 12 o'clock in the morning, you know, all these crazy hours. And I was just so frustrated, I didn't know how to handle it. And as I say many times, the only way I could handle that situation was by taking expensive, the more expensive equipment, the better. I just took all this test equipment and magnetrons, and as they made me go up to check my equipment, I go up past the flight deck, and I just over the side, just get that. Just the knot in my gut would go away, and I just feel good for a minute. And I said, do that again, you know? I dare you. Of course, nobody knew what I was doing except me, but that was all right. But I made a career decision. I had such a resentment going against the Navy. They say resentments are harmful. Well, for me, my resentments got me educated anyway. Because I was so mad at the Navy, I decided that I took a high school equivalency test, and I decided to go back to college, and I wanted to become something. And I really didn't know what the hell I wanted to do. But I know, especially in the service, on the lousy wage that they gave you, I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. I was, like most sailors, I was broke, you know. Today, you know, I did certain things, which I won't discuss here in the next crowd, but I did what I could to get the money that I needed to drink, but it was never enough. And I said, I'm going to go back to college, and I'm going to become, I'm going to become an accountant, because I just thought accountants had a lot of money for some reason, you know. I knew that, unfortunately, I find out most of it's just numbers on paper, you know, it's not cash in the pocket, but that was the way I made that decision. And that's what I did. I got out of the service May of the year, and I was going to start school the following September. And I had I must have had about $8,000 saved up, because the last med cruise we were on, it was suggested that I not go ashore, that I stay on a boat for the whole cruise. And I used to loan money out. You know, that was a good business. You loan out 5 to 7 for 1 week. You know, that's a pretty good rate of return. And I made a ton of money, and I used to play cards and, you know, all this type of stuff. And I accumulated a vast sum of money. Plus, when I got out, I decided to take the summer off. I needed a rest before school, so I went on unemployment. I bought myself a car, and I had all this money and the unemployment check, and I had a good summer. But September came around, I was broke. All the money was gone. The car still ran, and if you saw me coming down the road, it looked in pretty good shape. But if you looked at the rear, it wasn't in very good shape. There's most of the bars I drank it. I drank in. You used to drive, you know, drive in head first, and then you had to back out. When I was drunk, I couldn't quite manage which way to turn the wheel to go this way. And half the time I'd go that way into the telephone pole. And that's the way that car was until my brother, who doesn't have a drinking problem, drove it into an oak tree. But that's his problem. That's his story. Anyway. But I did. I went back to school, coming from behind, that's when I do best. You know, I was an old person. I was 22, and all these other people are 18, so I felt they all knew more than me, and I felt I was, you know, I was way down at the bottom, and I had to prove something. So I worked hard, and I proved something this first year, and I got accepted into a real quality accounting school in New York City, and, you know, everything looked like it was going good. I was working at the Reader's Digest, making a couple of dollars, but my drinking was pretty much under control. I, then I went downtown, and I had met my first wife at this time, and we were going out, and everything was going good, but I just had a drink. I couldn't deal with the problems of everyday life. I was not a risk taker. I was I just didn't fit in. I just felt better when I was mildly drunk, and I think about that, I used to think that it was after my third drink, everything seemed to get better. But it wasn't the third drink that was really doing it. It was the alcohol effect from the first drink. So by the time I had the third drink in me, I had that good feeling. Even if I stopped drinking, the excess alcohol would have gotten me past the edge. So I never did get that feeling that I got when I first started drinking on a few beers a night. But anyway, I went to school, and I got married at this time, and I was working in the bank, making a pittance while I was going to school, and I used to give the check to my wife because she was bringing in most of the money and supporting us. But I used to get supper money, like $2.50 a night or something like that. I forget what it was, $3 a night or something like that. And I never told her that I got that money, and I used to sandbag that money. That was my mad money, $15 a week. That's how desperate things were. But somehow, rather during that time, just before I graduated, I went to a wedding with my wife and another couple. And when the wedding was over, I stayed for another wedding. And then somewhere along the line, they went home. And when I started home, I got into a big car wreck, big six-car wreck, and totaled out this car. I was driving my old man's car at the time because my brother had totaled mine. So I wrecked this car, and I got locked up, and found out when I got to AA that I was locked up in the tombs, which is, in AA, that's something to be proud of, I guess. I thought it was the center street jail, is what I thought it was. But I, that was not a nice experience. I had been locked up several times in the service, and this was even worse. Somehow, no matter what time it was, I always got locked up drunk early, and that was the worst thing. And I could do well, but when I got, I could be drunk as hell. When I got put in a jail as soon as I hit the door, that metal door, I always hear it, the metal door slamming shut, for some unforeseen reason, it would sober me right up. And then you'd be sitting there until 8 or 9 o'clock the next morning. Oh, well, that was, I didn't like that. And this is when I still had these social drinking, Once I became an alcoholic, I never got locked up again, for some reason. I just couldn't handle that anymore. I was going to be, I never did get locked up again, as I say. But that was my goal, not to get locked up. But I finished school anyway, and I tried to become a CPA, and they wouldn't let me sit for the test without character reference letters, which I couldn't ask anybody to write on my behalf. These are people that I knew and liked, and who'd want them to perjure themselves, So I said, screw you for the CPA Society. I'll go back to school and get a master's degree. So that was the other resentment that got me educated, and I got a master's degree. And going to graduate school, I knew I had trouble with drinking. I almost flunked out because of drinking. Just stopping for a couple of drinks before a final exam. That was the easiest exam I ever took in my life, and I almost flunked out of school because of it, because I wasn't quite as creative as I thought I was going to be after a couple of drinks. But anyway, I did get out of school, and I went to work for a company, a subsidiary of CBS in New York that made movies, and this was a perfect job. I took care of certain financial forecasts and everything, but there wasn't much to forecast. Every movie we made bombed, so except the first one did all right, But tell us, you didn't have any money coming in, you had to pay your bills, you just get on the phone, you call the treasurer's office, they put more money in your bank account, you write the checks out. What a great job. But during this time, my drinking really started to pick up, because now I was making more money than I needed to pay the rent and everything. I had saved a couple of grand for down payment on a house, and I was living in a house. I had one kid at this time, and soon I have a second kid, and everything was going good. Except I couldn't make it, but now at least I had this money. I had this extra money coming in, and I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And I started drinking every day at lunchtime at this time. And instead of just you know, occasionally, but you know, starts off going over for sandwiches, any beer, sandwich and a beer, sandwich and six beers, you know, and that's it. But you get the sandwich, and I got caught in one of these buyback situations. You know, being an accountant, these are important things. If you're a drinking accountant, a buyback is when, you know, when you get buy three, you get the fourth one free. And no matter how many you intend to have, if you have that second drink and you rationally look at the third drink and realize it's half price, you can't turn it down. So you go right from two to four. And anyway, in New York City, it's barroom etiquette never to walk out after a free drink, so you have the fifth one, you buy it. And somehow you start talking to people, and lo and behold, you have the sixth drink. Uh-oh, the seventh one is a half-price drink again, you know. And I did that so many times, not every day, thank God. But that's the way I used to do it, and I'd come back, and, you know, not that it mattered too much at that company, nobody seemed to care. But I'd come back, you know, pretty well lit several times a week. And then I'd drink on the way home. You know, I'd tell my wife I was working overtime. I never worked overtime except maybe two or three times in my life. But I used to go home late all the time from the office, you know, drunk. And I used to drink on the train. I'd buy a six-pack before I got on the train and drink it up by the time we get down to where I lived. And then I'd get in the car and I'd ride home through, you know, for about 10 miles through a field so you couldn't even have a wreck. It was just a cabbage field on both sides of the road. And get home, open the door, run in, pour yourself a drink and take a sip of it so that there'd be a reason for the alcohol on your breath so that you'd deceive them one more time, you know. And that's the way I lived. And it was, you know, it was just falling apart fast. But fortunately, we got moved to L.A., and we'll lose my train of time here. The company thought that if we moved to L.A., people would go to see their lousy movies. But, you know, talk about alcoholic thinking. And that's what they did. They packed us up, and I always wanted to move somewhere, but I never had the courage. You know, I was not a courageous person. I knew things would be better somewhere else. I knew the benefits of making a geographic. I didn't have the courage. But here they made one for us, and Christ, I moved I packed up the furniture, I put a Volkswagen in the moving van, firewood and everything. I moved everything from the house, you know. Fortunately, we bought a house out here, and, you know, everything was going good for about a week until I, maybe 10 days, until I discovered the backstage, which was right across the street from the CBS studio. And the same thing that happened in that damn Irish bar in New York was started right over again. Boom, just like that. And, I met a guy in this program I used to drink there. You know, I was amazed when I saw him here. And, you know, we're both still in that industry. And we would do the same thing. You know, he worked on the Gunsmoke show then. And, I didn't know he was an alcoholic. He didn't know I was one. We just thought we were heavy social drinkers, you know. But we found ourselves here. But it was the same thing with buybacks and everything. It's hard to find buybacks in California, but I found them here. And, but I knew this wasn't going to last. This company, you know, they were going to fold it eventually. And I started looking for a job when I came out here the night before a big earthquake in 71. And I started looking about a month later, really, not hard, but I started doing preliminary work and taking interviews. And it took me from March until December to get another job. I think mostly because most of my interviews were taken after work, after lunch anyway. And I don't think I was too impressive. But I was hired by a guy from Oklahoma, Dry Carter, Oklahoma. And when I called him from the drying out hospital a couple of years later, he didn't even know I drank, you know. I don't think he ever saw anybody drunk. So he was the person who hired me. And this company was a complete zoo. I mean, you had two factions. The goddamn dope addicts and pill takers and pot smokers. And the higher class alcoholics, you know. The real men, you know. You know, I came from in New York. Anybody who took pills of dope, you know, they were those commie pinko fags, you know. And the guys I drank with, they pick you up on one of the new buildings they were constructing and throw you off if they thought you were on drugs. But so I hung around with the alcoholics, you know. And this place was just one big zoo. It was a great company. Everything was going fine. We were in the forefront of technology. The company was just had no place to go but up. We were making a new line of electronic calculators, and all the parts were coming in. We had just gone public. We had a whole bunch of money in the bank, and the credit lines with banks. And then one of the suppliers couldn't deliver one part. So we could never make the calculators, and all this inventory is piling up, and then we had to pay for it. So all the money we had, and the stuff is still coming in, because it was all on order. They never canceled it because the supplier kept saying, any day now we'll have this part. So they're building calculators 80% complete, 90% complete, waiting for this one part for one PC board to finish the whole thing. But what's happening is now we don't have any money left, and people want to get paid, and they're calling up to find out when they're going to get paid, and there's no treasurer's office to call anymore. So I have to take the calls, and I don't relate well with people. And I have all these pressures of book work. Finally I had a semi-spiritual awakening, and I said, wait a minute, this book work can be done in the morning. I know what these people want to see. I'll just make the numbers come out that way, and they'll make a year-end adjustment for obsolete inventory, to wipe everything off. And I found if I went out and had lunch, I'd be a little more mellow, and I could talk to these vendors in the afternoon, and I could tell them what they could do with their accounts receivable. In fact, I found out that my first sponsor, a guy who was in this group named Darrell F., his part, he was in the business. He was one of our suppliers, and I threw his partner out of the office one day, him and the president of our company. But and I don't remember any of that. But things were going bad. We were having meetings with bankers in the morning, and I couldn't handle that. So, because I was at the point now in the morning, I shook. I shook all morning until lunchtime. And if I tried to stop from shaking, I'd break out in this horrendous sweat. And it looks kind of weird at meetings. So I had to tell my wife that I had to do some undertime as well as overtime. So I had to get in at 6 a.m. in the morning and have some shooters just so I could get those shakes and sweats to go away so I could conduct meetings. And that's the way I handled that. I didn't want to drink in the morning because by this time, I was trying to characterize an alcoholic over here and myself over here, just to keep justifying it. I was just a moderately heavy social drinker. And, I had criteria like drink in the morning, no. Get home every night, yes. I get home every night. The alcoholics don't. Get to work Monday morning, yeah. And, one of them went that time. And then another one went. I started missing coming home every night. I go over to the house where these bartenders used to live, and I hate to admit it, but they used to smoke pot at night, and I'd be over there drinking. And at first I resisted the pot, but eventually, I just joined right into them, and that was horrifying. That was my moral code going down the tube. But, and it just went down. It just kept getting worse and worse. I had one horrendous weekend when I went to help this friend of mine out, who a fellow alcoholic, my best friend, who subsequently died in a VA hospital in Ohio somewhere because he didn't find this program. I went to help him out. He was having trouble with his marriage. I virtually didn't have one at the time, but it was still together. And I got him to go home on Friday at lunchtime, and I didn't get home until Sunday morning sometime. And I wasn't going to make it to work Monday morning, and I was just through. Here I was, I had a pack of pot in my pocket. I didn't smoke one or two. I'd buy get it from this one guy, bought a pack, and I put in a pool pack, and I'd smoke them on the freeway and going through Topanga Canyon or wherever the hell I was. I didn't, I was a chain smoker, And here, remember that night, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't lie down, and I was just dying. I had to go outside. I'm sitting on the curb in my shorts smoking a marijuana, and the kids across the street come home, and I had just been yelling at these kids, trying to tell them that their drinking is getting them into trouble, and that they should stop smoking pot and start behaving like responsible citizens, So And they come home and say, "Hi, Miss Adelman." And I say, "Hi, hi." And the next day, I allowed my wife to take me to a drying-out hospital over here in Westwood. And I went to a program there, and I just wanted to get well. And I stayed there really 1 week in-house, and then I stayed there another week part-time. And, I shook off the effects, but in that hospital, they took me to a couple of AA meetings, and, I had read books. We had a lot of literature about alcoholism around the house, and every once in a while I'd glance at it, just out of curiosity. And I don't know what the hell was going in the house, because my wife was obviously not an alcoholic. But I guess I really knew at that time that I was an alcoholic, but of a different type, the type that couldn't be helped, certainly not by any spiritual program. That was my strength, was that I felt that I was not an atheist, because I always had fear. I always looked over my shoulder, but I wanted to become one. I tried hard. I read books by weird authors who were atheists, but I always had that fear. But I just didn't want to admit anything. I just wanted to do everything on my own. And anyway, a program like that wouldn't pay. It was bad enough I had to go to this hospital and give them a $500 deposit, Fortunately, they went out of business before I got around to paying them the balance. But that's all it cost in those days. For a month, it probably would have been about $2,000, I guess, just projecting the numbers out. But it was relatively cheap. But, they got me to go to some of these damn meetings, and I was at the point where, the reason we went to that hospital was my wife was going to go in for marriage counseling because she was getting ready to split. I was wondering why we didn't go to one in the valley, but when she told me that, it got my attention, because I knew that if she split, all these years, to myself, I blamed these problems that I had on my father. If only that SOB had bought a house earlier and taken out a mortgage and gotten us out of that lousy town, it would have been different, and I blamed him for everything. And I also said, when that guy dies, I'm going to live on his, inheritance, because he still had a bunch of money. This is before the big inflationary spiral. If I had waited for him to die, he died last year, but after that inflation, I don't think I would have lasted 1 week drinking. It would have been a short retirement. But anyway, I just didn't want to get this, and that, I didn't really care if the wife left with the kids, but I didn't want to get cut off by the old man. That was my primary concern. So I said, I got to fix this for a year, and I'm gonna stop drinking for a year. And I made that commitment to myself. I can make those sick commitments and stick by them. But I also said, maybe it's a good facade to keep going to AA anyway. It doesn't mean anything to me. I'll go to AA and I'll make it look real good. I'll go on Monday night when there's Monday night football to make it look like I'm real sincere, And that's what I did. I started going to this meeting in the valley, up at the Nest. And I went there about four Mondays. And then the fourth Monday, all these goddamn drug addicts came in and took over the meeting. And I said, not for me, another funny thing happened, which you can't call funny anymore. I believe it was God working in my life. The following Monday, I had to work overtime, real work overtime. And I worked in West L.A., and there was no way I could get to the valley in time for the meeting anyway. And I had remembered that they, when I was at that hospital, they had taken me to this meeting off of Sepulveda somewhere on Ohio Street. And I found Ohio Street, so I went to that meeting, and I had been to several meetings in the valley and see these huge "We Care" signs, and I'd sit in the back and didn't feel like anybody cared to me, It never dawned to me that I could go out and introduce myself or ask somebody what's going on here. I just sat in the back and said, these goddamn people don't care, But I came into this Monday night Ohio meeting, and there was no "We Care" sign out, but I never got in the door. I never got that far to look for the sign, because everybody was out there shaking my hand. And, it was strange, but it really felt good. It felt like I was at home. I mean, here people are welcoming me coming. Everybody was always welcoming me going, but never coming in many years. And it was good. And I just, enjoyed that meeting, and I started going to that meeting. I was a person who couldn't talk to people, you know, and but I just kept going to that meeting, and every once in a while I'd share problems. I still had trouble deciding whether I was an alcoholic that could be helped by the steps. The first step was no problem. I didn't know what unmanageable life meant, but I knew I was an alcoholic and I couldn't drink. And, you know, I said, that's about as far as I could take the first step. But the second step, I said, my God, my sanity is the only thing that's keeping me going. And then I shared to somebody, the problem I had, the worst problem I had not drinking was at lunchtime. I'd sit in my office and I'd go crazy waiting for everybody to come back and start work again. You know, I just couldn't wait for work to start. And I even tried going to a meeting. Somebody mentioned Serenity Manor. I saw 26 on Broadway Wednesday afternoon. I went there. I went and I saw four buildings. And, here I am. I have an MBA and I see Serenity Manor. I didn't know what Serenity meant. And I walked into a goddamn geriatric hospital asking for a name. And, I got so embarrassed I left, you know. I never came back to 26 on Broadway for 10 years until I had to speak there one time. And I mentioned that, that was the tough time. And somebody at the meeting mentioned to me, did you ever consider going out to lunch at lunchtime? And I never had. That was the sad thing. I just white-knuckled it down lunch. So I started going out with the people to lunch, and that got better. But that was in retrospect, that was an example of my, little clink of my sanity armor anyway. But I was still having a tough time. I didn't even know I was in the Pacific group for about six or eight months. And I was gone every Monday night. I didn't know who Clancy was. That's the type of person I was. I was incapable of asking for help. But I got close to a year of sobriety. By this time I was going to the Tuesday night meeting. I started going there and met a guy in a class of 73, got me to go to that meeting. The guy was there in San Diego now. And it was good. I started to pick up. I started to know people. And after 51 weeks, I fired myself as a sponsor and I got somebody else. So it was really what it was. I surrendered. It was really what happened. I remember Morris telling me, you have to surrender. And finally dawned on me what that meant. And I knew I was going to fulfill my obligation to myself and stay sober a year. But I also knew deep down that I was going to be gone out there drinking again if I didn't do something, take some actions. And I asked somebody to be my sponsor. And that's when things started to get better. That's when the corner turned for me. But it took a long time. And, most people aren't that sick that they can stay around that long before they can turn the corner. That's why I said that earlier, that it's important just to stick around here because you never know when it's going to happen. Things are going to start falling into shape. And after that, they did. They started going into shape fast. I got a commitment at our Saturday night meeting on that one year that we had two secretaries at Infamous Year. I got a six-month commitment on the coffee crew, and there you had to stand right out there. And people came by to get the coffee. You had to shake hands with them. You had to get to know the people, and that was extremely important to me. And I got to know everybody, and I got to love that meeting. And, it was so sad when that meeting closed down. But oh, I'm getting better all this time. I took a fourth and fifth step, and then I really felt part of the group, and I really felt part of AA. And, it's just been steady, slowly but surely. I look back. I thought everything was great at 5 years. When I had 10 years, I thought everything was, when I look back and when I had 5 years, I said, my God, I don't know nothing. I learned a lot in the next 5 years. And now that I'm almost at 15, I can say the same thing. It's a continuing process and slow and steady. People have these miracle recoveries. You don't see too many of them around. The people have the real hard, long-lasting recovery periods, the ones who seem to survive, and I'm grateful in that way. I work my program today to the best of my ability. I try to work that 11-step, going to work every day in my car. So many good things have happened to me, and I only got 1 minute left, but I finally did get the courage to take that CPA exam and pass it. I went through a horrible divorce, and I got married to another wonderful lady. We've been married about 3 years now, and life just keeps getting better and better as long as I keep working this program, and thank you.